you've been searching for that time to get on some sort of a roll here to get that good feeling, and you need a game like this to give you a chance.
We're still struggling to try and score goals night in and night out, but we've been able to do that in the last couple games.
Jets have some life.
It doesn't get any easier as the season moves on. Road games get tougher and tougher. Oh,
there's not an easy answer to that.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Ezra, Dave, and Drew on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, man on my far left, Dave Minuk. Man in the middle, Ezra Ginsberg. We got 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. A jam-packed show. Of course, the NHL playoffs underway, so we will be heavy into the NHL playoffs throughout the program. But we know that this is a Winnipeg Jets city through and through, and we got your bread buttered with the Jets coverage today. Hour number three, an end-of-season Winnipeg Jets roundtable. We're going to welcome back to the program our good friend Scott Billick. He covers the Jets for NHL.com. Jeff Hamilton from the Winnipeg Free Press. They're all going to join us in studio for a Winnipeg Jets end-of-season roundtable. That's going to start at 11 a.m. this morning, so you can look forward to that. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news. Moose still plugging away. What, one more game to go, Dave?
Nope, last night.
Last night was it, and yeah. They ended with a 1-0 win, but yeah. a bang. You said that... Vincent was kicked out of the game.
Yeah.
Game misconduct.
Yeah, game misconduct.
Pascal Vincent, I couldn't remember his first name there for a
Patrice
second.
Patrice Cormier, captain, he got kicked out.
Darren Kramer was fighting on the bench.
Oh,
it sounds like
Darren Kramer got to a massive tilt. Yeah. I think Brian Strait also got thrown out. So there were four guys thrown out from last night's game. So you're right, they ended it with a bang.
Yeah, exactly. So the Moose season comes to an end. They also finished strong, 4-1-1 in their last six to end the season. Good
the
morning,
most important thing, though, is that Eric Comrie was on the show last week and he got a shutout last week.
It's the Illegal Curve rub. Yep. That's what that is. It's obviously any player who's struggling needs to come on to this program, chat it up with us. Boom, shutouts, hat tricks, whatever they're looking for, whatever they need, they can obviously get that just by hanging out with us.
By the way, Drew, before we get into the show here,
yeah,
I got to give you some major props.
Major props to Drew.
Yesterday, Naomi and I are driving down Wellington Crescent.
Uh-huh.
And we're about to go do some errands, hang out with my sister and nephew.
Very nice. Nice way to spend a good Friday.
Yep. We live in Osborne Village, of course, as do you.
I do. It's
and,
true.
And Laura and Aaron.
Yes.
And Naomi and I are, about to pass right around kind of St. Mary's Academy there, so Wellington and Academy. And we look over. Naomi's driving, and we look over, and Drew has Aaron in the stroller, taking Brixton for a walk. And he's actually also bending over to pick up a little Brixton poo. But Drew, we honk at him. He still has time to wave, so he's got his baby in the stroller.
Yep.
He's picking up a little dog poop, and he's still managing to wave to his friends.
And I had my headphones on all at the same time.
Did you?
I was listening to my music at the same time. It's a work of art, really, watching me walk the dog, walk the baby, and take care of the dog business all at the same time.
It was pretty funny, and then I texted you later, and you basically said not to bug you when it's not an icy game day.
So. Pretty much. I said the restraining order is still completely in effect and to please leave me alone. We'll get right into it with the Winnipeg Jets coverage. Of course, it was last Sunday and last Monday. Sunday, of course, being the players, the quote-unquote garbage bag day where they do the end-of-season interviews after a disappointing year for the Winnipeg Jets. And then Monday was Paul Maurice and Kevin Cheveldayoff's turn at the microphone as they give their thoughts and insight on what was, again, a disappointing Winnipeg Jets season. So, gentlemen, having had listened to the players in particular, because with all due respect to Paul Maurice and Kevin Cheveldayoff, didn't really glean many insights into their end-of-season comments. From listening to the players, though, I thought the players were a lot more honest and spoke a lot more... there was a lot more interesting comments coming from the players than there were from the front office types. Blake Wheeler in particular, referring to the season as a missed opportunity, as a disappointment. What did you think? A wasted opportunity? What did you think of the comments that were coming from the players last Sunday as they wrapped up their duties at the MTS Center?
Yeah, Drew, and you expect to hear that the players are using the word disappointing a lot when you miss the playoffs, and that's going to come from any player on a team that misses the playoffs, right? But you mentioned Blake Wheeler talking about, you know, this season being a missed opportunity, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the Jets won the last seven games and they really finished the season strong. Not just those seven games, but in March and April, they had a strong finish, but obviously, you know, falling 6 or 7 points short of a playoff spot. But yeah, you're going to hear the same rhetoric, not only from the general manager and the coach, but you're going to hear that from a lot of the players. And, you know, Blake Wheeler being the captain, he's the most outspoken player on the team. You guys know that after every game, Blake Wheeler is going to talk to the assembled media. Mm-hmm. So I think it was kind of refreshing to really hear that disappointment in his voice, not just using those words like disappointment and missed opportunity, but really talking about kind of why this team he thinks can make the playoffs next year. And I think that goes for everybody on this team, guys. I don't think there's anybody in that Jets dressing room that doesn't think this team can make the playoffs next year or who didn't think they could make it this year, right? So there were tough parts of the schedule and there were a lot of injuries that they had to deal with. So, you know, Blake Wheeler and Matthew Perreault, those comments I think were refreshing is the word that I use, but again, there's nothing new there. We expected them to not be, I guess, apologetic for not making the playoffs, right? I mean, these guys have pride, and you know, garbage bag day is always a tough day. These guys wish they were playing in the playoffs. So in that sense, you know, there was nothing new for me really, Drew, in those comments. I mean, I expected Blake Wheeler to say it was a disappointing season. And as far as Matthew Perreault goes and his comments about the goaltending, for me, that was a little bit surprising.
Well, I mean, I guess he's honest. I mean, Matthew Perreault, when you interview him, he's definitely the most forthright and direct of all the Jets players. Whenever you have a chance to have a conversation with him, and you know, yeah, there was a little bit of surprise that he was so honest that he made a comment like that. But I mean, the truth is, if you listen to one interview that any player is given, and let's reference Blake Wheeler himself. I mean, I'm at with the Jets every game, and after every game, he'll say something like, "Well, offense isn't our problem." So he may not be saying exactly explicitly what Matthew Perreault said, mm-hmm. but he's essentially saying that by saying offense isn't our problem. Well, if offense isn't your problem, then what is? If you're not winning the games, it's defense. And now he's not specifically saying goaltending in that it's a save situation,
which is what Perreault said.
Right. He'll more likely suggest that it's a collective team effort to keep the puck out of the net, and that's what they need to do as a collective. But which Perreault, I believe Perreault Matthew said that as well, and then he talked about them being better as a unit, as a 5-man unit or a 6-man unit, if you want to include the goaltender. But you know what? I don't really have a problem with it because I think it's ironic to me that we have a problem when a guy makes a refreshingly honest comment, and then people also conversely have a problem when someone says absolutely the most generic comments ever, sure. and you don't get anything out of them. So I'd rather have someone who speaks his mind and says something. And look, he wasn't wrong. They do need to make – they need the saves. I mean, it's not a question of that. Did I think Connor Hellebuyck had a decent season? Yeah, he had a good season. For all the expectations and for the role he was thrust into, in my mind, prematurely, there's no doubt about it. He had a good season. But the fact of the matter is, do they need some more saves out of Connor Hellebuyck? Sure. But do they need to play better defensively as a group? Yeah, absolutely. So I think, like, to isolate the goalie solely wouldn't be fair. But I think the goaltenders definitely played a big role in why the Jets didn't make the playoffs.
And, you know, Blake Wheeler referenced the schedule and he referenced the injuries. And, you know, the comment, I like to hear Blake Wheeler say things like, you know, there isn't a team in the NHL that's as skilled as we are and we didn't feel overmatched on any particular night, right? I like to hear that. You want to hear that confidence from a captain. Some people might call it cockiness, but I wouldn't call Blake Wheeler a cocky player. He's a confident guy. He's the leader of that team. You want a leader to say things like that to the media, that, you know, we're not going to feel like we're overmatched by any team. So, again, I mean, I didn't really find any comments on – I wasn't there. Dave was there. But as far as I was concerned, nothing that was said was, to be honest with you, that interesting to me. Yeah. I think these guys are just really going through the motions, right, Drew? I mean, they're trying to get out of there and, you know, make their off-season plans.
Well, and the one thing the follow-up I would have on Wheeler was that he said it feels like a wasted opportunity simply because of the talent they had on their team. Well, he thought if we were in a rebuilding mode with a really young team, which is kind of what they had discussed in the preseason, you know, with going young and bringing in some of their youth, then maybe that would be seen as a, you know, growing pain, right? But he thought it was a wasted opportunity simply because of the talent they had on the roster and where they should have been.
Because the younger players, which was always sort of the question mark around the team,
yeah.
at least the forwards, I mean the defense and the goaltending obviously still a question mark, but the younger forwards developed at a pace much quicker than they would have anticipated back in September when they first gathered for training camp. That's why he was saying it was a wasted opportunity of a season. And I echo that. I mean, going back to September, October, when we were doing our predictions, if the Jets were a playoff team, I said they weren't going to be a playoff team because I thought the learning curve for the younger players would be greater than it turned out to be. Mm-hmm. And that's why, again, from my perspective, you know, it is a missed opportunity. It is a wasted opportunity because you had these young guys excelling, I think, at a rate faster than anybody would have expected. You know, nobody necessarily thought Mark Scheifele was going to be as good as he was all season long. Nikolaj Ehlers, Patrick Laine, obviously these guys, it seems like they took a step faster than everybody expected, and the team still couldn't capitalize on their improved play.
You know, Drew, you mentioned that was the reason why you thought the Jets weren't going to make the playoffs. And if you think about it, that wasn't the reason why the Jets ended up missing the playoffs.
Not to say that
your feelings weren't valid.
That's why it's such a wasted opportunity, because what I thought was going to be their bugaboo and what I thought was going to be their Achilles heel turned out not to be their Achilles heel. It was something entirely else that probably should have been addressed by management during the course of the year. Hey, look, these young players are exceeding our expectations. This, the goaltending, the defense, this is where we are falling behind. Let's try and fix that problem in the midst of the season.
Right, because Josh Morrissey emerged, I think, as the team's top left side defenseman. Patrick Laine is going to be a Calder Trophy finalist, scored 36 goals. And I mean, obviously, you could point out to Kyle Connor and say that he struggled a little bit, but it wasn't youth that cost this team a playoff spot. It was some shaky goaltending at the middle part of the season. It was special teams. Mm-hmm. It was lack of discipline. It was, sure, blame injuries and blame the schedule. I mean, you really can't forget that Brian Little and Tyler Myers being injured was a huge reason why the Jets struggled in that November, December, January portion of the season, right? Not having Brian Little, your second line center, was devastating for this team. Not having Tyler Myers, a guy who plays 25, 26 a minute, is devastating for this team, right? And, you know, they're not necessarily going to use that as the primary excuse, but that was a contributing factor, as was a tough schedule, as was lack of discipline, as was a poor penalty kill and a poor power play, right? So youth was part of it at times. I mean, we saw Nikolaj Ehlers and Patrick Laine struggle at times with turnovers and, you know, lack of awareness on the defensive side of the puck. But certainly no one in the Jets dressing room is going to say that this wasn't a disappointing year. And they only finished 6 or 7 points out of a playoff spot. And part of that was because of the run they had at the end of the year. But yeah, I truly believe that this team isn't that far away.
I don't think they are that far away either. They have an impressive group of talent currently on the ice. They have holes that need to be filled. And I think if Kevin Cheveldayoff and if the brain trust of the Jets do not fill those holes this offseason, then you're going to be in the same position next year. I don't think the improvement that they're looking for, you know, the holes that they need to fill is going to come necessarily from internal improvement, because I don't see those players being on the roster.
Oh, no, they absolutely, Drew, and talking about Kevin Cheveldayoff and management, they have to go out and address these issues via trade or free agency, absolutely. And we're talking about the goaltender position and on defense. I think that this team does lack a defensive shutdown defenseman on the left side. I think Josh Morrissey is emerging as that. And he's obviously got some offensive upside as well. But I think when you're talking about the goaltender position, realize Michael Hutchins had finished strong there. And it was nice for him to pick up those 4 wins at the end of the season. But I think everyone in this room and most in the assembled media and even fans will tell you that this team does need another goaltender to push Connor Hellebuck.
What did you think quickly, Dave, of Maurice and Cheveldayoff's comments? We haven't really touched on them. They didn't say, no surprise, neither of them, you know, they talk a lot. They don't really say anything of any substance. Did you glean anything from their comments?
No. I mean, I posted both and articles yesterday on the website about both Maurice.
They both don't want to lose their jobs.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, Maurice basically said he's comfortable going into next season on his current contract. I mean, some people call that lame duck. He's saying that I've done that before. He did that in his first year where he didn't have the extension. Obviously he was only there for, you know, he was only signed till the end of the year just to kind of clean things up for the Jets, and then they'd see see where they went. I could see them going, giving him another. I mean, the reality is it's pushing towards an extension. There was talk of that earlier, you know, in the season, but the problem was the Jets were kind of in a swoon, and I don't know that it would have looked great if you're giving a coach an extension when your team is losing. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you know, they had to kind of put that on hold. Now the word was that the Maurice himself put it on hold until the summer. We don't know if that's
you
true.
You do
or
it
not.
In mid June. There's a lot less
you know, exactly
ramifications.
And again, like I said, like the fact that, you know, Kevin Cheveldayoff said, "I want to finish what I started," does, you know, makes. Isn't that all that surprising? I mean, he's the architect in theory of this team, and he has to kind of wants to see it through. We'll see if that happens, but you'd have to think that they'll probably both get extensions sometime this point this summer.
When we return, there were plenty of coaching and general manager moves throughout the league this week, as of course the season comes to end, and with it usually comes Black Monday. It was black for a number of teams and a number of coaches. We talk about the coaching changes throughout the league up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
The Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Los Angeles Kings have fired president and general manager Dean Lombardi and head coach Daryl Sutter. Lombardi and Sutter led the Kings to their first Stanley Cup in franchise history in 2012, but after capturing their second cup in 2014, the Kings have missed the playoffs in two of the last three seasons. Rob Blake has been named the general manager and vice president, and Luke Robitaille will take over as club president. Both have been with the Kings front office. Blake for 4 years as the team's assistant GM and VP, while Robitaille has spent 10 years as the team's president of business operations.
What have you done for me lately? Two Stanley Cups in five seasons means naught, as both Daryl Sutter and Dean Lombardi of the Los Angeles Kings are now ex of the Los Angeles Kings. They were relieved of their duties after the Kings missed the playoffs this past season. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey, and sponsor of the ICOT Pool. Any playoff game that goes to overtime, use hashtag ICOTPool. Select the player that you think is going to score. Win great prizes.
Congrats to the Muffin Man.
The Muffin Man won last night's Rangers-Habs game. He's going to win. So he won some great prizes from Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club.
He probably wanted some muffins.
Yeah. Do you know the Muffin Man?
I don't know the Muffin Man in this instance, but I do know that he's off to Rumors Comedy Club.
He's famous now.
Yes, you can be off to Rumors Comedy Club as well. Jeff McHenry is there tonight. Two shows, and of course, don't forget, it's April, which means both Sean Wayans, Kevin Heffernan, and Steve Lemmy, the guys from Super Troopers, are going to be at Rumors at the end of this month. Tickets available, rumorscomedyclub.com. So we focus back on the Los Angeles Kings with a complete front office overhaul, as Daryl Sutter, head coach, he's out. General manager Dean Lombardi, he's out. And they instead introduce Rob Blake as GM and Luke Robitaille as president of the team. Was it time in Los Angeles? I mean, I know that it's only 3 years ago that Sutter and Lombardi had led the Kings to their second Stanley Cup. Was it just time? Had the sands run out of the hourglass and it was time for a new change, a new voice, a new leadership team in Los Angeles?
And these are the days of our lives?
There you go.
I'll be honest, Drew, this caught me by surprise. And I think many people were expecting Daryl Sutter to be fired, but for Dean Lombardi and Daryl Sutter to be fired at the same time, I think at the very least surprised me. And you mentioned the two Stanley Cups that the Kings won in 2012 and 2014, but the Kings have missed the playoffs for two of the last 3 years right now. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about this LA Kings team, I mean, I think there's so many fascinating questions about this move, because Rob Blake has been the assistant general manager since 2013 after working with the NHL, and then Luke Robitaille has been with this team in a business capacity. I believe his title was president of business operations or something along those lines. So he's been affiliated with the team for quite some time now, and he's arguably the greatest king of all time, right? So I think it's no surprise that Luke Robitaille and Rob Blake, because are replacing Dean Lombardi in kind of that regime change, because sure, they've kind of been, you know, the heir apparents there for quite some time, Drew. But when you look at this Kings team, again, I mean, is this going to be a complete rebuild or rebuild on the fly? Because when you look at who the Kings have up, locked up long-term, you've got Anze Kopitar locked up long-term, Dustin Brown is locked up long-term, Jeff Carter's locked up long-term, Marian Gabrick, which was a horrible contract that was signed by Dean Lombardi, he's locked up for another 4 years. Drew Doughty's got 2 years left on his contract. He's going to get $10 million a year once he becomes a UFA. You've got Alec Martinez and Jake Muzzin locked up long-term. And then you've also got Jonathan Quick locked up for, I believe, 6 more years. So you've got many players locked up for a long period of time. Now, I think we'd all agree that Rob Blake would love to get rid of the Dustin Brown contract. He'd probably love to get rid of the Marian Gabrick contract.
You have to think they're going to buy out Marian Gabrick this offseason.
There's certainly a good chance of that happening, Drew. And, you know, I would imagine the biggest, number one on Rob Blake's to-do list right now will be re-signing Tyler Toffoli and Tanner Pearson, who are both RFAs. But again, when you look at this team going into next year, they're still a pretty good defensive team. They just had so many problems scoring goals. I believe they were at 201 goals, bottom five in the NHL, right? And one of the main reasons I believe that the Sutter-Lombardi regime was fired was because they didn't really stay with the times, right? The Kings teams that won the Cup in 2012, 2014 were heavy teams, defensive teams that relied a lot on their defense and goaltending, but they just didn't evolve with the rest of the NHL. When Mike Sullivan was hired by the Pittsburgh Penguins, took over there for Mike Johnston, really the NHL did turn into a speed league, mm-hmm. and all of the teams were kind of copying that. So a little bit surprised that they lost their jobs, and it's going to be interesting to see where they go from here, because I think we expect John Stevens to be hired as the head coach. He's the assistant now. Davis Payne was the other assistant. He was let go. So regardless if it's John Stevens or someone else that's brought in outside of the organization, they have a lot of work to do here because they don't have a lot of top 10 draft picks in the system.
They don't,
you're talking about Adrian Kempe as your top prospect right now, right? Like they don't have an Austin Matthews or a Patrick Laine waiting to join them next year.
Not even that. They don't have it was always the comparable. You do the Blackhawks and the Kings, and they're the two teams that you'd always compare one against the other. And the Blackhawks have been able to shore up, you know, both teams have their core, and then the Blackhawks have been able to always shore up those missing pieces with quality talent, whereas the Kings have struggled to do that. Besides, I mean, Anze Kopitar, who actually had a down season this year, and Jeff Carter, who had a good year, the bottom guys in Los Angeles have never been able to produce at the level at which the Blackhawks, sort of second string guys, have been able to do it. And that's, I think, ultimately the bad contracts and that inability to fix those holes with cheap young talent is what costs Lombardi his job.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the key is, as you just touched on, Drew, the bad contracts. I think that when you have contracts that really, I mean, think about it, the Kings were always up against the salary cap. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the Kings having like a minuscule amount of money available. So it really hampers your ability to make any sort of move when you don't have that any money available or space in the cap to do it. So
Mike Richards was another contract.
Yeah, and not only that, mm-hmm. they have like recapture penalties for Richards for the next few years. Like they're literally like up against it.
It's still one of the fact that they don't have Mike Richards' full contract on their books is one of the most is a scandal that no one in the NHL talks about. I mean, when the fact that they were able to get him off their books because of whatever happened with him at the border, which turned out to be nothing ultimately.
They also bought him out though.
Well, no, but they bought him out in a manner in which both sides came to some sort of agreement. It was a very bizarre sort of agreement that they came to where they were able to, I mean, I don't want to use the word cheat the system, but if I was one of the other 29 NHL teams when that Richards contract shenanigans went, you know, took effect, I would have been upset because the Kings should even be further behind the eight ball with the salary cap situation.
I think the Kings' inability to draft well.
Yes.
Has been a huge issue. And you mentioned that they haven't been able to really deal with the salary cap like the Chicago Blackhawks have.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have a guy like Cale Clegg, who's a promising defenseman, former Brandon Wheat King, played for Canada at the World Junior Hockey Championships and played very well, I might add. But, I mean, this team, I think, when you look at it, it's going to be pretty similar next year, Drew. And, you know, how active is Rob Blake going to be before the expansion draft? How active is he going to be at the draft? I think he's going to be one of the more active GMs.
He obviously has holes he needs to fill, and if there's any way he can get contracts off his book, that'll be great for the Kings. But it's a delicate situation in Los Angeles. I think they're always going to be on the cusp of a playoff team, but you look at them and you wonder if their window of being an actual Stanley Cup contender hasn't closed.
Oh, no, that's closed. I mean, well, they didn't make the playoffs, right?
Right.
And you know, you mentioned, you know, Jeff Carter had a great year, and I like Tanner Pearson's game. I liked Tyler Toffoli's game. And, you know, the group of defensemen they have there, at least their top three with Doughty, Muzzin, and Martinez is still good. But after that, it's pretty weak, and a guy like Cale Clegg will help. But again, defense was not the problem because Jonathan Quick was very solid. And when Peter Budaj was filling in for Jonathan Quick because of the system Daryl Sutter had in there, mm-hmm. he was very solid. So goaltending and defense wasn't the problem. They just don't have enough guys that can put the puck in the net.
And I don't see how that's going to change necessarily anytime imminently because I don't see that new wave of talent coming in to allow them to score.
The truth also is with Sutter, I mean, think about it. 2015, the team locks him out of the room, and that was kind of minimized by them overall. But if you think about it, when a team is doing that to a coach, it's not showing a very high level of respect, especially if it gets out.
Mm-hmm.
So right then and there, you had an idea that, okay, something's a brewing. But, I mean, it goes to show you, I mean, the Kings are a team that really weren't a playoff contender prior to the ascension of Lombardi and Sutter. And then all of a sudden, these guys win 2 Stanley Cups in 5 years, and suddenly next thing you know, They're out with the trash. So,
yeah.
It just goes to show you how the NHL a lot of times is what are you doing right now? What are your prospects for winning? And if you're not good, then that's going to be a problem.
It is a very difficult business at some points in time. When we come back, Kevin Allen of USA Today joins us. We'll talk about the Stanley Cup playoffs with him. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Oh, on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, Saturday the 15th of April. Drew Mindell, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend Kevin Allen. Kevin covers the NHL for USA Today. Kevin, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure's all ours, Kevin. Obviously brought you on to discuss the Stanley Cup playoffs. They are now, I guess, what's this now? 3 days old, having started this past Wednesday. I want to start with the Blue Jackets-Penguins series with you, which you've been keeping a close eye on, no doubt. And I go back to the first period of Game 1 of that series. The Penguins obviously lead the series 2-0, having won both games in Pittsburgh. You know, Matt Murray gets injured in warm-up. Marc-Andre Fleury has to come in, unexpectedly, of course, but, you know, the comfort that comes with a veteran backup there certainly on display. The Blue Jackets outshoot the Penguins by a 16-3 margin in that first period of Game 1. Fleury doesn't give up any goals. The Penguins are able to score first in that game, and it just seems like they've been a bit of a runaway train ever since that first period came and went, and the Penguins were able to get on the board first. How have you seen that series, having, you know, up close and personal, how have you seen that series unfold so far through 2 games?
Well, I mean, that's the series I chose to cover to start the playoffs, and the assessment is right on the mark. Like, it felt like in that first period, if there was ever an opportunity for the Blue Jackets to take charge, it was right then. I mean, already it was going their way when Murray goes out in the warm-up with an injury. But Fleury stepped in, and now all of a sudden the decision early on to ride it out with Marc-Andre Fleury really is paying off for the Penguins because, you know, as Mike Sullivan pointed out, it was like we had 2 number one goalies throughout the season, and while it was difficult during the regular season, it's paying off now. And here's what's remarkable. As you pointed out, like, not only did they have a great start in Game 1, but the Blue Jackets had a great start in Game 2 as well. And had really the first 8 shots on goal, and then Sidney Crosby scored. It turns it the other way. Like, yesterday, the Blue Jackets almost played a perfect road game. 51 hits, 40 shots on goal, and they lost 4-1. And I think that's the story thus far of this series, and that is the Blue Jackets have not played poorly. In fact, I think they've played reasonably well. I think their goaltending could have been a little better. But saying all that, I mean, this Penguins team is performing at a very high level. And they're, you know, sort of drawing on the experience they had last season, you know, when they went all the way and won the championship, and they're using that, I think, to sort of try to convince themselves that, you know, if they're just patient and continue to play their game, they will get their opportunities to win it.
Kevin, it got a little ugly towards the end of game two with Matt Calvert breaking his stick on Tom Kunockel's neck, and then he gave him another shot as he was going down. Are you expecting there to be some discipline for Mr. Calvert of the Columbus Blue Jackets, and are you expecting the rest of the series to be just as ugly as the first two games?
Well, I mean, I do expect, and I think I would expect it would be severe. I mean, if the NHL wants to assure that this is not going to get out of hand, I would assume they'd try to take him out for at least most, if not all, of the rest of the series. I mean, the optics of that hit was exactly the type of shenanigans that we do not want to see, you know, in the NHL. And, you know, I couldn't even believe it. I mean, I was aghast at what transpired there, and I do think it will be a severe penalty. The only thing I would warn and caution is that, you know, as established when Brendan Shanahan was the director of player safety, there is a sort of a precedent to this, and there is some method to the madness. And I haven't looked this up yet, but I don't remember Calvert being in any trouble before, which will weigh in his favor. And Kunackle is hurt as well, and of course, if he is not, that will mitigate some of the damage as well. So, you know, we're going to have to see how that all kind of plays out. But there's no doubt he'll be suspended. It's just a question of how long.
Kevin, one of the most fun things about hockey is the unlikely heroes, which you wrote about yesterday in USA Today, who leave their mark in the NHL playoffs. And we saw it with Tom Wilson scoring the overtime winner, or Zach Cassian's shorthanded game winner for Edmonton the other day. What is it about these unsung heroes that makes it so much fun when they get the play a big role in these games?
Well, I mean, it doesn't really happen in any other sport, to be honest with you. I mean, occasionally, you know, there's a big hit in baseball, but in football and basketball, it's usually the stars that carry the day. And to be honest, in baseball, most often it is as well. But not so in the NHL. I mean, just because of the nature of the overtimes and the fact that the wages diminished to the minutes are divided up by coaches, it really does provide an opportunity, you know, for a lesser-known player to grab the spotlight. And historically, that's happened, as I pointed out in my article. I mean, one of the great names in the NHL tradition is Mud Brunetow, who, of course, scored the goal that ended the longest game in NHL history. And so that was only the second playoff game of his career. He's only been called up for 2 weeks when he did that. And, you know, we've seen a lot of that through the years. Chris Kontos, John Drews, Peter Klima was benched for most of the game, and then in the third overtime stepped up. And I think, to me, it's what makes the sport so unique and fascinating. I think when I think of playoffs, those are the guys that I think about, just sort of the odd guys who have stepped up and created the goal that will be remembered for years and years and years.
Kevin Allen of USA Today is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're discussing the Stanley Cup playoffs with him. Kevin, I think the prohibitive favorites to meet in the Stanley Cup final are the Chicago Blackhawks and the Washington Capitals. Both teams struggled in their first in their opening games of the playoffs. Capitals obviously end up defeating the Maple Leafs in overtime on that Tom Wilson goal. The Blackhawks get shut out at home. Pekka Rinne with the shutout. You know, just sort of opening game jitters maybe for each of those two teams, or do you think there's something a little more concerning in what you saw?
Well, I don't think. I think both of those teams, should thrive. I think probably the Blackhawks face a bigger threat than the Capitals do. Like, I love this Toronto Maple Leafs team. I believe in the Shannon plan. I think that Lou Lamoriello and Mike Babcock were the absolute perfect choices to lead this renovation project, and they've just done a remarkable job. This team is well ahead of schedule, but you know, it's really a team for 2019. Not 2017. So I think the lack of experience is going to be their undoing. Like, they're an exciting offensive team, but I don't think they come close to matching the overall depth and experience that this Washington team has. So I think, as you said, jitters played a role, and I think you know, the Capitals will be back on track because this is the best team the Capitals have ever had. And that's saying something because even though they don't have a history of postseason success, they've had some good teams. You know, they just have failed to come through. But I think this team is the best prepared to try to win a cup. Now, the Blackhawks situation is a little bit different. I think the Predators are, in terms of when you size up the playoff team, are probably pretty average. You know, they don't do anything particularly well, other than I do really like the skill level of their defense. But, you know, they're also don't have any weaknesses either. So they're the team that's very scary to me because they can go in and they can score just enough goals to be dangerous. They play well enough defensively to be dangerous. And their goalie, as we saw in game one, has potential to save it for them. But, you know, to me, the strength of the Blackhawks is the fact they have won three cups since 2010. It's like they got a master's degree in playoff success. Like, they know how it's done. They have tremendous survival skills. And I think they'll figure it out here and survive this series. And that one thing that is true is, even though I think what they've accomplished this season has been impressive given the fact that each time they've won a cup, there's been an erosion of their depth. They're still not as strong as they've been in the past. And I think that's the one thing you have to be concerned about. But I think they have a great opportunity to win the cup. They just need to play their style of game.
Kevin, when you consider that they're without Paul Stastny and without Robbie Fabry, how surprised are you that the St. Louis Blues are up 2-0 in their series with Minnesota?
Yeah, that to me has been the biggest surprise. You know, this Minnesota team is actually pretty good. But like, Chris Boudreau did a really remarkable job of taking a really dysfunctional dressing room and sort of brought peace and harmony to it. You know, the Wild are not the Wild of Jacques Lemaire era. I mean, this is a team that can score some goals. It's a good offensive team now. And they've got their quality goaltending. Dubnyk has turned out to be the goalie that the fans in Edmonton hoped he was going to be, but he never was there. So they've got a lot going for it. But what happened in St. Louis is the coaching change to Mike Yeo has really benefited the team. I think they were very weary of Ken Hitchcock's voice, and they've really sort of turned it around. And Jake Allen has stepped up. He's been the goalie that they had hoped he would be. And I think that's, you know, been a big difference. And, you know, I like their defense. They've got the most dynamic scorer in the West, and Tarasenko. So they've got a lot going for it. And but saying all that, I'm still a little bit surprised that they're up to 12.
Kevin, one of the could be the one of the most physical series of the playoffs will be the Flames and Ducks. There's two teams that have no love lost. What has impressed you so far about that series?
Well, you know, that was my upset special, and you know, and it was all based on a hunch. Like, you know, just the fact that everybody was talking about that the Flames haven't won in Anaheim since 2004, and, you know, the season series went the Ducks' way. I just had a feeling that the Flames were going to step in there and, you know, maybe upset the apple cart a little bit. But, you know, I've been really impressed by the way Getzlaf played in that opening game, and I think they sort of sent a message with that. And you know, their goaltending now seems, I think, that, you know, Gibson has finally reached the stage where you're not going to have to worry about goaltending for them. So even though I picked an upset in this series, now I'm starting to wonder whether that's truly going to be the case.
Yeah, always second guessing at some points in time. Kevin Allen with us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Kevin, San Jose and the Oilers. The Oilers win 2-0 last night on the strength of two shorthanded goals. That doesn't happen every day, certainly in the playoffs it doesn't. Yet the series is 1-1 after the Sharks won in overtime in game one. A classic battle of a veteran team versus the up and coming team, the team with youth on their side. Is this a series? Do you see any way that this series doesn't go pretty close to the distance? It just seems like they're two evenly matched teams, and the Sharks, even with their injury concerns, just don't seem fazed by the youth of the Oilers thus far.
No, they really don't. And this is really going to be a quality series. And I don't remember. It's been a long time, anyway, since I've been this excited about you know, the debut of a young star like Connor McDavid in a playoff series. Like, I was really looking forward to seeing what he was going to do. And I think a lot of it is because I really enjoyed what Wayne Gretzky did at the All-Star game when he said publicly, it's almost like he threw the gauntlet out in front of Connor McDavid and said, you know, if Connor McDavid is going to be the best player in the league, he has to dethrone Sidney Crosby. And, you know, McDavid took that first step when he outpointed him to win the scoring championship this season. And then I think everybody is now looking and think, okay, now what's he going to do in the playoffs? And I think Gretzky knew exactly what he was doing, and I think he knew that Connor McDavid would respond to that challenge. And I think the situation with San Jose now is a little bit different. You know, I just said that, you know, the Maple Leafs are relying on younger players and they weren't going to be ready until 2019. Well, that's a different story for the Oilers. Like, yes, they're counting heavily on a couple of young players and one very important young superstar. But this team, because of what Peter Chiarelli has done, is a little better prepared than the Maple Leafs are. So I think the Oilers are going to win this series. I do. And that's saying a lot because I think the Sharks have been sneaky good for a lot of years. And by that, meaning I don't think they get a lot of credit for what a talented team they really are. And, they reached the finals even last June, but I don't think they got the respect that they really deserved. But I think this Oilers team is excited and motivated, and I think Connor McDavid is a very special player.
Kevin, last question for you here, and getting away from the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs for a second. The big news coming out of L.A. earlier this week that the team had let go Dean Lombardi and Daryl Sutter. What were your thoughts on this move, considering that, you know, the Kings have won, you know, two cups in the last 5 years?
Well, to be honest with you, I was surprised by that. And it just goes to show you that it really is in a parity league. What have you done for me lately? Because, you know, two cups in 3 years by the Kings wasn't that long ago. And already, they've looked at Dean. I mean, Dean Lombardi didn't wake up one Tuesday morning and suddenly didn't know how to manage hockey. It's the circumstances of this league is now is that it's hard to stay on top. And I think there's always been, and I think this is fair criticism, is that if you compare what he did with his team after they won, compare what the Blackhawks did with their team. Dan Bowman in Chicago after they won, each time they won, he reassessed, he moved out some guys, he basically had loyalty to fewer players than Dean Lombardi did, and he found a way to stay on top by changing his roster. Lombardi didn't do that. He was very loyal to his guys, and that got him in trouble because he has a couple of contracts, the Gabrick deal and the Dustin Brown deal, that really have caused him a lot of problems and made it difficult for him to maintain the team's place in the standings. I think he paid a price for that. Did he deserve to? I would argue not. But that's not the way it is now in the NHL, and that's why he's looking for work.
Kevin Allen covers the NHL for USA Today. Always one of our favorite guests to have on the program. Kevin, appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for doing this morning.
Yeah, call me anytime.
We do, Kevin. Thanks very much. When we come back, we'll touch on a few of the other coaching changes throughout the league. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show returns. Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
I always coached the way I thought was the right way. I did what I thought was the best for the organization and the team. I guess I was proud of our team. Like, after Christmas, we were in a playoff spot, and, you know, that was a thin lineup that people didn't think we'd do much with, and our guys battled hard, and for us to be in that spot said so much about our players and their character, and it was just disappointing that we couldn't keep it together after.
That's Willie Desjardins, now ex-head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, as he was shown his walking papers as a part of Black Monday in the NHL. going to go through a number of the other moves that were made in the coaching and general manager ranks. Should make note, though, that this segment is brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. So Willie Desjardins in Vancouver, he's shown the door. No surprise really there, but I'm not sure that it's really deserving. I mean, he did, from my perspective, a pretty okay job with a pretty flawed roster that was given to him by Trevor Linden.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that, Drew. And, you know, that was his third year with the Vancouver Canucks. And I would, you know, look at this team and I would say that they're not really heading in an upward direction when you consider that the Sedins have only got 1 year left on their contracts. Just really the talent on this roster. I mean, I like many of the young players that they have on this roster, whether you're talking about a Bo Horvat or a Jake Virtanen or a Brock Besser, who got into a little NHL action towards the end of the season. But certainly it's one of those tough situations, right? I mean, Willie Desjardins was almost a lame duck coach this year for the Vancouver Canucks. And they obviously felt that he wasn't the right coach to kind of lead this rebuild, right? And you could argue that the Vancouver Canucks should have been rebuilding last year.
Yeah, they should have hired him to start the rebuild 3 seasons ago.
Right, and, you know, there's a lot of head coaching candidates right now out there that would love to have that Vancouver Canucks job. And I think I would prefer a veteran coach to take over that position with a young team. You know, Travis Green is a guy that seems to always pop up this time of year as far as potentially being the next head coach of the Vancouver Canucks. But again, I mean, when you talk about whether it's fair or not that a coach should be fired, I mean, I don't think any coach, you know, is going to think that it's fair that he was fired, right?
Yeah.
Unless, the expectations and the results were that far apart. But, you know, this wasn't to be unexpected, I think, even though, as you said, I don't think many people were picking the Vancouver Canucks to not only make the playoffs, but go far in the playoffs. So, you know, it's a situation right now where they're going to have to realize that it is a major rebuild there. And there is, the potential, that the Vancouver Canucks are a bottom five team for a couple of years to come. You saw it with the Calgary Flames. You saw it with the Edmonton Oilers. I mean, That's where they are in this cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Edmonton Oilers just made the playoffs for the first time in 11 years. So
it's probably
Vancouver's time to sit on the sidelines for a bit.
I would agree with you there. Dave, off to Florida, where the more things change, the more they stay the same. Tom Rowe, who was in an acting capacity as head coach and quasi-general manager, is no longer in either of those roles. Dale Tallon, who was quote-unquote promoted last offseason, is back as the full-time general manager in Florida. Just goes to show you that, boy, they sort of, a lost season in Florida, victims of, you know, self-inflicted wounds in Florida, and they decide that the man that they had before is the right man going forward, and that's Dale Tallon as their general manager, still unsure of who's going to be the new head coach in the with the Florida Panthers.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes to show you that sometimes players don't like the moves that get made by management, and they maybe let their feelings get known. And we heard from the Panthers players earlier in the season, you know, I mean, again, they didn't explicitly say that they were unhappy with the moves, but you know, you could kind of sense it from some of the comments that were being said out in Southern Florida. So I'm not terribly surprised by this. Tom Rowe is still going to be a special advisor, whatever that means, within the organization. And look, there's a number of people who want to coach in South Florida. They have a nice crop of talent, and the fact is that they weren't that far away from winning the division. You know, so this is a team that potentially, and the one thing that should factor,
only one season removed from,
that's
winning,
what I'm saying,
the division,
from winning the division. So the one factor that really comes into play, and Jets fans can understand this, is that they did have a number of key injuries in the season to some of their top scorers and their defensemen. So that was also definitely play a role in the overall production of the Florida Panthers. But it's a talented group that I could see some coach wanting to get that opportunity.
It just goes to show you how significant, when there's upheaval sort of in the management ranks of a team, how it can trickle down to the players and I think impact their performance on the ice. Now, you can't make a direct correlation necessarily, but when players look around and they see the organization in flux and they see a lot of confusion and there's, you know, who's the actual general, you know, who's leading this team, I think that probably to some extent factored into the Panthers and their disappointing season as well.
Yeah, that might be the case. But when you look at the Florida Panthers and where they are, it's almost kind of polar opposite of where the Vancouver Canucks are. You just mentioned it, Drew, you know, coming off of winning the Atlantic Division. But, you know, the Panthers have 10 players that are under contract past 2020, mm-hmm. up until 2020, 2021. And, you know, you mentioned some of their struggles maybe had to do with the fact that, you know, there was some upheaval in the organization. But, you know, the injuries to Nick Bjugstad and Jonathan Huberdeau earlier in the season and some down performances by some of the players they expected to take the next step is also going to factor in there, right? So, I mean, the Florida Panthers, you know, we talked about it quite a bit towards the end of the season. One of the most disappointing teams in the NHL, along with the Dallas Stars and the Tampa Bay Lightning. And, you know, the Stars and the Panthers go from winning the division to missing the playoffs. And, you know, this is a team, I think, you make a few tweaks. You're not making a lot of major moves here.
They can't. I mean, they have everybody under contract.
Well, exactly. Thomas Vanek, don't expect him to be back next year. Jaromir Jagr, he's going to be probably signed to a one-year contract. But, you know, when you're talking about Barkov, Trocheck, Bjugstad, Riley, Huberdeau, and on defense, Ekblad, Demers, Yandel, I mean, these guys are all under contract long-term. Same thing goes with the goaltenders, Luongo and Reimer. So, I mean, I expect this team to be back in the playoffs next year. I think this is just a down year all across the board for them.
The Panthers' former head coach was Gerard Gallant. He is now the inaugural head coach of the Vegas Golden Knights. They announced that earlier this week. Right choice for to lead an expansion team with Gerard Gallant?
Yeah, it remains to be seen, right? And
well, you're not going to put on your fortune telling hat.
I mean, anybody who's saying that it's the right choice, I mean, he's an excellent coach. I've always liked Gerard Gallant as a coach. And, you know, that goes back to, you know, his time coaching with the Detroit Red Wings and the Montreal Canadiens. But this Golden Knights team is not going to be very good for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
If Vegas Golden Knights fans are expecting this to be a playoff team in year one or year two or even years three and four, I mean, I think they're in for a rude awakening, right? And that should be the expectations in Vegas. I mean, they're going to ice a competitive team. Gerard Gallant is going to have these guys competing on a nightly basis, but I don't think they're going to be a team that's going to compete for a playoff spot, in my opinion. We'll see what happens. I've been wrong many times before on this show, but
Well, remind me what your preseason Stanley Cup prediction was.
Yeah, Dallas and Florida. So
they're competing for something. It's just the golf title right now.
Yeah, it's the first overall pick, I think.
But, I mean, let's be honest. Gerard Gallant has an impressive resume, not just as a coach, but as a player. And I mean, I was shocked that he was fired as the Florida Panthers head coach, considering that, you know, he was an excellent coach for them and had them as the division leaders, right? So, I mean, in that sense, he's the right coach. I mean, I think you do want a veteran coach with a young team, but it remains to be seen, you know, how successful he is with this team. But again, the expectations aren't going to be very high for them.
No, doesn't have a steep learning curve. He's got a nice long leash, I think, to mold the Golden Knights in the vision that he wants. Coming up in about 30 minutes, Mike Hajka of the Dallas Morning News is going to join us. We'll talk about the Stars coaching decisions at that point in time. But when we return, Bill West of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review to talk about the Blue Jackets Penguin series, the Blue Jackets up 2-0. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, hour number 2 up next on TSN 1290.
You're on the Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Hour number 2 of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program Bill West. Bill covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. He joins us to discuss the Penguins-Blue Jackets series, a series the Penguins lead 2-0. Bill, good morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. How you doing?
Doing very well, Bill. Thanks very much. Want to obviously talk about the series, but I want to start with what happened at the end of the game last night. That's Matt Calvert deciding to do his best lumberjack impersonation. By the sounds of things, it looks like he might avoid suspension for what I think most people would refer to as a pretty vicious cross check to the head. What would your reaction be if Calvert ends up avoiding suspension and is only fined for that incident?
I mean, I guess stunned, but also just generally puzzled by the nature of NHL player safety. It certainly was an act that deserves punishment of some sort. So if they completely let it slide, then yeah, that's inexcusable. And again, kind of goes beyond reason and comprehension. But you know, the NHL has a strange way of you know, doling out punishment on such things. So, and you have to remember, it wasn't just that Calvert got that initial cross check that you know broke his stick over Tom Kuhnhackl. Then he managed to follow up with a you know kind of shoulder to Kuhnhackl's head while Kuhnhackl was bent over. So. It's just an ugly and completely unnecessary play and, you know, has no place in the game.
Bill, I think you'd agree the big story so far of this series is that Marc-Andre Fleury was forced into the starter role because Matt Murray was injured before the series started. If Matt Murray's good to go for Game 3, does Marc-Andre Fleury still get the start?
It's a good question. You know, the coaching staff has been pretty cryptic about their plan or really, again, the outlook for Matt Murray. All they've said is there is no timetable for Murray, which I think is somewhat indicative that it's not a you know, not a quick thing. He's not going to be back today, tomorrow. I don't think the Penguins practice in about an hour and a half, so we'll see and know then. But, you know, it certainly seems as if Matt Murray is dealing with you know, some sort of soft tissue issue, you know, probably from that New Jersey game a week or so back now, when Taylor Hall ran into him on a breakaway. So it might be a while, and Marc-Andre Fleury, you know, in kind of a strange twist of fate, might you know end up being the surprise hero in goal for the playoffs or for the Penguins this year, the way Matt Murray became last year.
Bill, Sidney Crosby had a relatively quiet game for himself in Game 1, then broke out, had 3 points in Game 2. Do you think it was probably a good idea that the Columbus Dispatch decided to cancel the crying Crosby mass for the first game in Columbus?
Yeah, that was another curious decision. I'm not really sure what the newspaper was thinking there. I suppose it would have sold well even you know after the way things played out on that Friday night. But, you know, it seems that trying to poke the bear that is Sidney Crosby doesn't really work out well for teams. You know, I know there were a couple of years there where Columbus or Philadelphia, there were teams that seemed to get into his head. But, you know, the nature of Crosby and really the Penguins as a whole right now is they just don't let this stuff bother them. And if anything, they respond with, you know, even better play. So, yeah, it's not a good look by the Dispatch and probably a wise move to just go ahead and do away with that promotion after all.
Bill West is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Bill is with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. We're discussing the Blue Jackets and the Penguins. Penguins lead the series 2-0. Game 3 goes back in Columbus. Bill, you know, the sort of chess match inside the series is, of course, John Tortorella versus Mike Sullivan, two guys who were attached at the hip throughout their coaching lives, really up until the split. But I mean, it wasn't an adversarial split, just that Tortorella goes to Columbus, Sullivan gets the job in Pittsburgh. You know, how much is that the sort of a behind the scenes storyline? These two guys who know each other so well, matching wits with one another.
I mean, I think so far, you know, they've certainly tried to downplay, you know, the fact that it is this chess match. I wish I could say I've been impressed with what John Tortorella has done, but at least what he said to the media was a little surprising, and I would say discouraging, because of course the narrative this year with Tortorella was he kind of turned a corner and learned to embrace, you know, the more modern facets of hockey, play more of a speed game, emphasize skill. But now what we're seeing and hearing is kind of classic Tortorella in terms of we need to be physical, we need to be the grittier team, we need to have jam, you know, all that stuff. And it's clearly not working against the Penguins. I think Columbus did a reasonably good job during the regular season in the head-to-head matchups because they did just try to play the game, and you know, there were times where it was more physical. But you know, I think that the fact that they're trying to swing the pendulum further in that physicality direction right now is just a bad idea, and it's going to be a very short series if they don't, you know, change their minds soon.
Now, Bill, in the couple of games here in the first round, looks like Mike Sullivan is really evenly distributing those D minutes, especially without Chris Letang. Ian Cole played just under 20 minutes, and then Trevor Daly had the most for any defenseman for the Penguins with 22. Without Chris Letang, is that something that we should expect to see for the rest of the first round and maybe even beyond?
Yeah. Mike Sullivan has said several times now that it is absolutely their intention to keep the minutes almost completely even across the board. They've said all along that you can't replace Chris Letang, and I don't think many people will dispute that. So the way they're going about it is to kind of have these different components who bring something that Letang did well, whether it was creating offense, which you can turn to a Justin Schultz for that, in terms of tough matchups and kind of defensive zone stuff. You can rely on Ron Hainsey or Brian Dumoulin for that. And, really just trying to piece together, a composite Chris Letang, if you will, that way. So it's been good so far. I'm not sure it is a sustainable plan or strategy against a team like Washington, where clearly it's going to require your best guys to go up against Ovechkin and Backstrom, some of those guys. But Columbus, because they don't have a lot of stars at forward, it seems like the Penguins can kind of just cancel out the offensive threats that are there by rolling their defensive pairs.
Bill, is it a bit of a surprise, though, that the Penguins have handled the physicality of Columbus so well? Because, coming into the series, that really was kind of what I was expecting, was that Columbus would try and kind of physically dominate Pittsburgh. But watching these games so far, Pittsburgh's shown that they haven't shied away from the physical stuff, and they've been able to successfully manage it.
I think that they're pretty well prepared and capable of dealing with it by now. They pointed out frequently last season during the playoffs that teams were going to try to push them around and intimidate them. Washington, that certainly was the game plan early in that second round series. And, at the end of the day, the Penguins are steadfast in their belief that their speed, can overcome whatever physicality and, kind of that grinding style that opponents want to bring. So, this series thus far has, kind of continued that trend. The teams, they can be physical, and they have periods of time where they can be maybe the more dominant team, but the Penguins' pace of play spread out over 60 minutes is just really hard to compete with and really hard to keep up with.
Bill West, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Bill covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. The Penguins up 2-0 on the Columbus Blue Jackets in their first round playoff series. Bill, the Blue Jackets have been able to generate a lot of shots on goal or shot attempts. Not a ton have been what you would call grade-A scoring opportunities. Why have the Penguins been so successful at keeping the Blue Jackets out of the quote-unquote scoring zone?
They're doing a very good job with five-man defense in their own defensive zone. The forwards are collapsing really low. They're kind of creating this little house around the goal crease, and Columbus, I want to say to their credit, quite the opposite. They're just not finding a way to get shots through or to create more off the rush, to basically create offense before the Penguins can get in this little shell. And the Penguins, what's been impressive is, even though they do create this kind of protective shell around Marc-Andre Fleury, they very quickly get out to loose pucks, whether it's a block shot or, again, a missed shot, or if they can tip away a pass and then go chase that down. So they're not a team that's just, kind of laying and praying in front of the goalie and hoping for the best. They have a plan after that initial shot goes. And I think the Blue Jackets are just a little stumped right now. They just don't really have an answer for how to get the puck, in those true grade-A scoring areas. And that's, John Tortorella the other day, sometimes you just have to hope. I'm not sure that's what you want to hear from your coach if you're a Blue Jackets fan, because that seems like that's a not really a substantive answer. But we'll see Sunday if they draw up new plans.
Bill, is there any chance that we see Carl Hagelin and or Chris Kunitz in this series?
I think Carl Hagelin is a more likely chance than Chris Kunitz. Both are back to skating in some capacity. Carl Hagelin is probably closer. I know he's closer. It probably will also depend on whether the Penguins feel the need to rush him back. I think, with the series going the way it is, they might just be happy with the things developing. They'll let things play out until they get the second round and then kind of reconsider how they should use the lineup.
Bill West covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. He joins us to talk about the Penguins-Blue Jackets series. Penguins lead that series 2-0. Bill, appreciate your time and your insight this morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Take care, Bill. When we come back, we'll do our own review. We start with the Western Conference playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Set up Tarasenko, he'll spin on Koivu, right out in front, a chance, they score! Joel Edmondson gets the goal, St. Louis wins in overtime.
The Blues win in overtime in Game 1. Jaden Schwartz scores late in Game 2. The Blues take a surprising 2-0 series lead over the Minnesota Wild. Steal home ice advantage, win both games in the state of hockey. Head back to Missouri with a 2-0 series lead. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Of course, pick up all your stuff for your barbecue, all your deli for your trip out to the lake. Whatever you need, Bernstein's Deli has you set.
Shout out to Mikey McMikeface. I saw him at Bernstein's on Thursday.
Mikey McMikeface. I know who it is. Formerly
Evander Kane.
I know who it is.
I don't believe that's Mikey McMikeface. His legal name.
He should change his legal name to Mikey McMikeface, though. That just rolls off the tongue. Like Bodie McBoatface. People name boats now. Yeah. Bodie McBoatface.
Naomi and I went there for lunch. I picked up Naomi from school, so I saw you know all of my friends at Brock Gordon School.
Uh-huh.
And picked up an icy sandwich on Thursday. It was great.
There you go.
Had a good conversation with Aaron. It's very busy though.
Yes, it's generally a sign of a good, well-run operation.
Yep.
That it is busy. If it wasn't busy, you'd be more concerned.
I had a side of fries too, Drew.
Thanks for sharing. Did you bring any fries for me?
I actually didn't have time to finish the sandwich because Naomi had to get back to
school.
Work.
Yeah, because she's a teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got children to take care of.
Yeah.
Educate, if you will.
She starts with educating Ezzy, so I mean, from all there, everything else seems easy at that point in time.
That's a tall task.
Yeah, anyways. Let's start with the Blues and the Wild series. This is sort of a toss-up series when we did our preview show on Wednesday in that the Blues, you know, were entering the playoffs, you know, playing pretty decent hockey. The Wild had slumped for much of March, played a little bit better there towards April. So far, I mean, this is a series that Jake Allen steals game one for the Blues, standing on his head. And then key goals, Joel Edmondson, not the guy that you would expect to be a goal scorer, has 2 goals in the series already. And then Jaden Schwartz, with just a couple minutes to go yesterday, snipes one past Devan Dubnyk, and all of a sudden the Minnesota Wild are down 2-0 to the Blues.
Yeah, a lot of goals coming from players from Manitoba and Saskatchewan, right?
Sure.
Joel Edmondson is tied for the league lead in goals right now, but I agree with you,
Drew. As we all expected.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the series goes, Jake, anybody who watched game one of this series knows that Jake Allen was absolutely incredible with 50-plus saves. And, you know, give the St. Louis Blues credit. Mike Yeo, formerly, obviously, coach of the Minnesota Wild, they make the adjustments and hold the Minnesota Wild to 24 shots in game two. But this game was much more close checking, less wide open, Dave. And, you know, give the Minnesota Wild, you know, a lot of credit. They've played well in the first 2 games here, but, you know, the only player that scored a goal is Zach Parise, right? So Jake Allen has been excellent. I think in this game especially, you know, St. Louis was doing an excellent job of keeping everything to the outside. Mm-hmm. We talked about it. You know, you mentioned, Drew, that we were predicting this as a close series. You know, I think I picked St. Louis in 7 games, if I'm not mistaken, and I wanted to pick, you know, St. Louis in 6 or something like that. But, you know, Minnesota's a very good team, even if they faltered a little bit down the stretch. But this Blues defense, even without Kevin Shattenkirk,
you had St. Louis in 7.
Yeah. And even though this Blues team doesn't have Kevin Shattenkirk anymore, it's big and it's mobile. So You're talking about Petrangelo, Bouwmeester, Colton Parayko, Joel Edmondson. And so as your top four, and you know, Dave, this Blues team, I think, you know, going into the playoffs, they were very good under Mike Yeo after he took over for Ken Hitchcock, but they've done an excellent job, and they have the experience. They've been here. They went to the Western Conference Finals last year, and do they miss Paul Stastny at center? Absolutely. You know, a guy like Vladimir Sobotka coming back from the Continental Hockey League has looked really good, but, you know, give them a lot of credit. I think Alex Steen has been very good. Mm-hmm. And
Jake,
you know,
Allen's out playing Devan Dubnyk right
now. He is, and, I mean, you could simplify it to that, Drew, mm-hmm. but, again, you know, we're talking about 2 one-goal games, right?
Absolutely.
So it's not like, you know, the St. Louis Blues are completely dominating the Minnesota Wild in any facet. I mean, let's be honest. There weren't a lot of penalties last night, and you just had not a lot of room out there. But, again, this has been the staple of this Blues team for years.
Yeah.
I mean, they do not give you a lot. We've seen the Jets and Blues many times. The Jets beat the Blues 5 times this year. Those games were all tight and close checking. So, you know, this series, we'll see what happens. But you steal 2 games in Minnesota. That's huge for Mike Yeo and the Blues.
And the psyche with Bruce Boudreau behind the bench and a guy who's had his struggles come playoff time, you can't help but wonder if that's maybe sinking into the back of the minds of Boudreau and or his players on the Minnesota Wild. Be a fascinating Game 3, a real key game 3 coming up. Moving to the Edmonton-San Jose series, the Oilers are able to even the series last night. They scored 2 shorthanded goals, and that series is tied up at 1 apiece after the Sharks. They were down 2-0 in Game 1. They score 3 unanswered. Melker Carlson wins it for the Sharks in overtime. It's just such a fascinating series. I love watching this series because the poise and the calm that sort of surrounds the San Jose Sharks while they're in the face of this young, youthful, speedy Oilers team, it really is just a fascinating series to watch. I'm so impressed with the Sharks, how even without Joe Thornton have been so even keel throughout the series.
Yeah, but I also have been impressed by the Oilers because...
Absolutely.
No, I'm just saying, but I'm saying, like, last night specifically, they had 4 penalties in a row. Mm-hmm. They not only did they kill them off, but they managed to score twice shorthanded, which, again, is almost unheard of in the NHL. And they've looked really good, and their role players are all playing significant roles right now. I mean, Zach Kassian, how many people expected him to have the game-winning goal yesterday with that shorthanded break? Nice play by him. It wasn't exactly coming with Connor McDavid-esque speed, but he sure made, you know, he took advantage of that opportunity that presented itself. Cam Talbot's played a great, you know, I mean, it's just, they're getting the production they need from the players that they expect it from, but the ones that they don't, like the Zach Kassians who have stepped up, Patrick Maroon's been really good in the series. I mean, he's played a little over the line yesterday.
2 penalties yesterday.
Took a couple of penalties. Yeah. So that's, you got to be careful. You got to really, and they talked about it during the broadcast. They talked about how you have to really watch because, you know, what is the ref giving you? And if the ref is, you know, going to give you a penalty that first time for that first kind of cross check, then you can't do it again later in the game because you're just going to put your team behind the eight ball. Now, the Oilers have shown that they were resilient and they played really well, and their young defense is playing particularly well. But, you know, like you said, Drew, this is a very veteran San Jose team. They probably are happy with the split knowing that Joe Thornton didn't play in either Game 1 or Game 2. Going back to San Jose with the split isn't a bad place to be for a veteran team like San Jose.
And, Dave, they played desperate hockey, right? I mean, you couldn't go back to San Jose down 2-0. You just couldn't do that against a team like San Jose. And I thought, you know, you mentioned, you know, the physicality in the series. The Oilers have to take less penalties. I mean, they can't be taking that many penalties. I forget how many penalties it was in the third period there, but it was just too much. And maybe they were trying to take, you know, I thought it was more than 2 penalties, but I think they had 6 penalties, power plays in the game for San Jose, if I'm not mistaken. And when you look at this Oilers team, I mean, that's what they did, and they went out and they acquired guys like Milan Lucic and Patrick Maroon, and that was a year before Milan Lucic, but they have guys that can play that style of hockey. Zach Kassian was running all over the ice. He hit Brendan Dillon, mm-hmm. which was arguably a dirty hit, and then he was also out there, you know, getting into Logan Couture's face. And, you know, this Sharks team still playing without Joe Thornton, and they
Couture
miss him.
Doesn't look himself either, I don't think.
Well, I mean, again, you know, like, Logan Couture is a guy that was instrumental in this team going to the Stanley Cup Finals last year. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have Logan Couture at 100% and you don't even have Joe Thornton in the lineup, that makes you a weaker opponent, right? And you're going up against an Oilers team that, again, I didn't think this team was making the playoffs at the beginning of the year. They surprised me big time, but there's a lot of skill and size on this team.
They're the quote-unquote favorite if you just look at where the standing, you know, how they finished in the standings this year.
Right, and that's partly due to the fact the Sharks had that losing streak at mm-hmm. the end of the year, right, and all of that, Drew. But, no, you're right. I mean, Logan Couture does not look like the guy that led the league in playoff scoring last year. But, you know, give the Oilers a lot of credit here. And Cam Talbot, you know, he gets a shutout. You know, he didn't have to make too many saves. I think it was around 20 or 22 saves that he made. So I didn't think San Jose generated enough offensively. Brent Burns has been very good in the first two games. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I mean, you know, Joe Pavelski, and I think Joe Pavelski was matched up against Connor McDavid's line, and we originally thought it was going to be a different matchup. We thought it might be the Yannick Hansen, Thomas Hertl line, but they've also made adjustments because you don't have Joe Thornton centering that line, right? So you've had to move some players around. Patrick Marleau, they've had at center. He's a guy that they've had at wing for much of the year, right? So you've had, you know, kind of forwards being have to move around throughout the lineup, right? So, you know, but again, give the Oilers a lot of credit. I mean, it was a very entertaining game. I don't remember the last time you had a team scoring two shorthanded goals.
The Anaheim Ducks, I thought I saw, it was Rob Niedermeyer, and I'm trying to remember who the other forward was who scored a shorthanded goal.
Sammy Paulson?
No, it wasn't somebody that jumped, that was a name, I would suggest. Not that Sammy Paulson's much of a name, albeit, but I'll look it up. I saw the tweet. It was either last night or earlier this morning.
They played on a line, you remember?
Yeah, I do. Anaheim-Calgary, let's go to that series. The Ducks, they only played one game. Game two goes tonight in that series. The Ducks win 3-2 over the Flames in game one there. You know, this Anaheim Ducks team, the more I look at them, nobody's really talking about them that much, and I look at them as a real threat to come out of the Western Conference.
Yeah, that game came down to that terrible line change, because the Calgary Flames were in that game, but it was an awful line change. Ryan Getzlaff takes the pass from Kevin Bieksa. You know, and it results in a goal there. You know, it was, you know, a game in which the Calgary Flames, I thought, were playing very well. It's another, you know, series that's had lots of physicality. But again, you know, that was a close game. And I, you know, for the Calgary Flames, you got to be concerned a little bit here. You don't want to go down 2-0 to the Flames. Pardon me. You don't want to go down 2-0 to the Ducks going back to your rink. You know, What else can you say about that series? I mean, the Calgary Flames, I think, almost at times got preoccupied with the physical stuff. Mm-hmm. And you had Matthew Tkachuk running around out there. And, you know, they're going to have to be careful, because this Ducks team can score and they can defend. And even without Cam Fowler, I thought they did an excellent job. So
dominating effort from Ryan Getzlaff in game one, I thought.
Yeah, he had 3 points.
Yeah, and he was a force all over the ice, and it looked like the Flames didn't really have an answer for him. And if Ryan Getzlaff's going to play at that level, it's going to be real hard for Calgary to win that series.
Well, and Jakob Silfverberg gets the game-winning goal, and, you know, people forget that he's a very good player.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in previous playoffs, he struggled a little bit, but, you know, again, discipline, you know, right? They get the power play goal, the winner there in the second period, and... You know, Calgary's going to have to be sharper than that. I think, you know, Glenn Gullitson, you know, has to be instilling into these guys that they have to be quicker on their line changes and they have to stay out of the penalty box.
Be a little bit sharper. Rob Niedermeyer and Kurt Sauer. The Kurt Sauer was the name I was looking for. They were the only two goal scorers in the previous 2-0 playoff game with two shorthanded goals. That came May 12th of 2003. Thanks to Elliot Friedman for that piece of information.
He just texted you that?
No, he had tweeted it. I saw that. I said that he had tweeted it. I just couldn't remember the name of Kurt Sauer. So it was Niedermeyer and Sauer who had the two shorthanded goals back in 2003. Dave, Chicago-Nashville. Nashville gets the 1-0 series lead on a 1-0 win over the Blackhawks in Chicago. Pekka Rinne looking like a vintage performance from that goaltender. Sort of that one surprised me. I thought that was going to be a relatively easy series for the Blackhawks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. I think Nashville was a little bit they had a chip on their shoulder coming into the series, because I don't think anybody was taking them particularly seriously. I think former Predator Jordan Tutu saying before the series began that it's nice to finally be on the right side of things probably was a little bit of fodder for the Predators room, being able to say, look, guys, nobody's taking us seriously. And, you know, even former Predators are kind of beaking at us. So regardless of the fact that it was Jordan Tutu, but still the fact is that, you know, nobody likes to hear that. These guys are professionals. So I'm not really surprised. I mean, it wasn't a dominating performance. It wasn't as if the Chicago Blackhawks got completely dominated. It was a beautiful goal by Arvidsson on that redirect. Yeah. to give them the 1-0 lead. And you're right, Pekka Rinne played phenomenally, which is what he's going to have to do to kind of keep down the Chicago Blackhawks team, which I don't anticipate him being able to do for the full length of this series. So, I mean, am I particularly surprised that Nashville won the game? No, not really. I mean, it's one game. And if they win the second game, I'll be surprised.
Game two of that series, of course, goes tonight. When we come back, Mike Hyka of the Dallas Morning News joins us to talk about the Stars coaching change. Lindy Ruff, his contract's not renewed. Ken Hitchcock back behind the bench for the Dallas Stars. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.